This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you really paid workers a fair wage here in this country, you would go to Target and you'd find a pair of shoes at Target you liked, maybe $300. And so ultimately that burden falls on the consumer. And no one's going to go for that here. No one's going to spend $300 for a pair of shoes from Target. So those jobs aren't coming back.
Take a look at the shoes you're wearing right now. You've probably logged more than a few miles in them already. But what kind of journey did they take before they ended up on your feet? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Spencer Wise, an author whose debut novel, The Emperor of Shoes, is set in an international shoe manufacturing enterprise. We discuss the labor conditions of the Chinese shoe factories Wise visited, explore the environmentally treacherous practices of leather tanning, and talk about how over generations, a small family business moved into the modern global economy. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my cousin and author, Spencer Wise. His debut novel is called The Emperor of Shoes. Spencer, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's an honor to be here.
Great to have you on the show. I just finished your novel, just came out. It's very exciting to have a novelist in the family. It's a novel about what? What do you tell people who are interested in learning more about it without giving the plot away to potential readers?
Well, it's about a young Bostonian, this Jewish American, who goes over to China to take over the family shoe business from his father. This is in modern day China, and he falls in love with a factory worker who may or may not be using him to start a pro-democratic revolution in the factory.
And the Wise family, we actually have generations of shoemakers in the family. Your dad, my uncle, is in the business still. Why don't you explain the journey you took in learning more about the family business and what you learned about the industry going to China?
I guess I always had this, any good Jewish book probably starts with guilt. And I had this feeling that I should take over my father's business from him and that I was being groomed to do this. And I knew I'd be very bad at it. I can barely add. So I'd make a lousy businessman. So I knew I either needed to go into my father's business or write a book about it. And I think I knew pretty early on which way I was leaning. While I was young, my father was basically in China for most of my childhood. So I sort of had imagined what this world was like. And when he was home, he was with our grandfather talking shoes. And as you know, they basically only see the world from about the knee down. They're just always staring at people's shoes as they walk. It's kind of creepy as they walk into restaurants. And so I wanted to go and see what that world was like. And so in the summer of 2014, I went over and lived in this shoe factory, stayed at the dormitory where the workers live in Foshan, which is right outside of Guangzhou. And I basically did an apprenticeship and learned how to make shoes. And this whole time I was interested in writing this book about the shoe business. And that was sort of on one part an homage to our family and to this long tradition of shoemakers and these Jewish immigrants who had come to Boston and America and made lives for themselves and succeeded. But I was also sort of really troubled by a lot of the environmental abuses and labor abuses that go on in the factories and the exploitation of the workers. And that's just as much, I think, a part of my family history as the other, the more glorified part of making these beautiful shoes. So I was troubled by that contradiction and wanted to explore it in this novel.
So that was kind of not really something you were seeking out as part of the story when you went there? Did you kind of have the framework already in mind that this was going to be labor issues, or was this something you already had in mind before you went over there?
Yeah, I had that in mind. I didn't have the exact plot, and I needed to do a tremendous research and interview a lot of the workers, some of whom were very forthcoming, others of whom didn't want to speak to me on the record at all. Sometimes I met with factory workers from other factories, and I had translators. But I knew right from the jump that I wanted to write a book that dealt directly with this world that most Americans choose not to look at, but that we depend on to sustain a certain level of comfort and quality of life that we're used to here in America. We're also so detached from our production and from the things that we consume, our food, and from the products that we use. They just land on our door, float down in a little Amazon box from the clouds. And there's people and lives behind them. And those are some of the stories that I wanted to bring to life in this book. And I knew I had a rare opportunity to do it because not anyone can get into these factories. You can't walk up to the security guard gate with who has a gun and say, hey, I work for the New York Times. Can I come peek around? So given my family's our family's connection in the business, I was able to take a look at something that I think a lot of people are interested in, but haven't read about before.
And why don't you talk about some of the characters that you didn't explicitly use in the book, but during your research, why don't you give us some stories that touched you and made you feel like you were on this journey to tell many stories at once, not just your own?
Right. I remember one thing that I saw. It's sort of an image and it's tough to capture, but in these factories, they use a tremendous amount, in the shoemaking process, they use a tremendous amount of glue. It's cement-based glue. And it had benzene in it originally. And they've been trying to phase that out for years. But benzene is highly toxic and induces benzene poisoning and the fumes. And you can see when you go around the factory, and it's almost artistic, these giant tubs, aluminum cans of glue, have sometimes spilled over and the glue has frozen like an icicle sort of as it dangles off the table. So you have this just like loose glue uncovered all over these factories with very poor ventilation. And while OSHA and the WTO and different organizations have tried to regulate that and get the benzene out of the glue, it's still a lot cheaper to buy the you know, poorly made cement glue and use a tremendous amount of glue in the shoemaking process.
And as a consumer, let's say you're going into Target or Payless or some fancy shoe store, what did you learn in your travels that would make you kind of think twice about buying something or feel more confident in your purchase?
In terms of natural leather, it's a tremendous amount of water and pollution. So there are these sort of pyramids stacked up of these cans of glue and that have been spilled. And a lot of people are they're dipping these brushes. You have very poor ventilation. You have just some of these factories don't even have fans. And workers are supposed to be using masks. Very few are wearing masks at all. And they're dipping these brushes into these like uncovered Coke cans full of this glue. And so it's all floating around. And you see people that have benzene poisoning. You can see it in the eyes, this discoloration in the eyes, the eyes turning yellow. And you see all kinds of sort of horrible, industry-related accidents, like people that have lopped off fingers from the leather cutting machines. They're called die cutters, or these huge cutting machines which take the imprints out of the leather. These big leather machines that bite into the leather, and people lose hands and fingers in them and all kinds of horrible things. And, you see them walking around the factories, and as sometimes the factory can decide to help these people with their medical costs, and sometimes they choose not to. But that's up to them. I mean, the only medical attention they'd receive would be paid through the factories.
Five names that I can hardly stand to hear, including yours and mine and one more chip who isn't here. I can see the ladies talking how the times are getting hard, and that fearsome excavation on Magnolia Boulevard. Yes, I'm going. same, and I'm laughing at the frozen rain. Well, I'm so alone, honey. When they gonna send me home? Bad sneakers and the pina colada, my friend, stomping on the avenue by Radio City with a transistor and a large sum of money to spend.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Spencer Wise, my cousin and the author of the new novel, The Emperor of Shoes. It sounds like one of the worst parts of the industry is tanning these leathers. Why don't you explain what a tannery is and how that affected your perception of the shoemaking industry? Or just leather products in general.
Yeah. Well, tanneries, for leather products, whether they're coats or shoes, is the process of taking, taking the protein that's in leather and turning it into a fiber. And you do it to making it something stiff that you can wear that doesn't rot. And you do that through, there is a natural way to do it, which Native Americans practice, called veg tanning, essentially, where you can bury it in the ground. It takes a long time. But in the Industrial Revolution, what it brought us and like what our grandfather used, and there's lots of articles about this. I mean, there's 40 factories up in Haverhill that were all dumping these chemicals into the Merrimack River. And there was a big joke from an article that I read when I was doing my research. That was like, you can't find a fish in the Merrimack River. And it was because all these mills were just dumping in it. And what they were dumping is chrome and sulfur and lye and lime. And these are the chemicals that you need to wash leather hides in, animal hides in, to ultimately tan them so they can be used in the production of shoes or coats or any leather purses, whatever you want. But the question is then, how do you extract the chemicals from the water? And one of the things that's amazing about these tanneries is it takes a tremendous amount of water to make shoes. Especially in tanneries, they're just going through all these baths. You're bathing these hides in these gigantic drums, and they kind of spin around. If you just think about a giant dryer, laundry dryer, and they're just flopping around in these drums, and then you let the water out that's full of these chemicals. Now, where does that water go? You know, and traditionally, it's been really dumped into. In our time, it was dumped in the Merrimack River, and now here it's been dumped into the, you know, South China Sea or into the ground. And while I was there, there were some people making efforts to start recycling programs. And it's amazing. At the tanneries, they have these like flues running down these chutes on the floor that the chemicals just run down, and it's just the water's blue with chemical.
I'm glad you mentioned the issue of recycling, because I was going to ask, is it done on more of a private for-profit basis there, or is recycling in China happening because of some sort of governmental policy that you're aware of?
Yeah. Now, again, I'm not an expert in all of, Chinese policy here, but from what I saw, the recycling efforts were driven more on the as a way to appease and placate the buyer. So that would be whomever is buying the shoes, making the shoes, not the customer, not us, but Clarks or, you know, Prada or whomever, you know, the brand. So the people that want to make shoes there, they want to know that they're making shoes in an ethical manner and in as green as way as possible.
So the multinationals that have like a sustainability officer in place and supply chain issues that they need to account for to their investors, they're the ones who are actually
putting the heat on these factories that they develop programs. And then it's very difficult to ascertain how well that's being met. And certainly I could see from some of the tanneries that efforts were being made in that direction, but how sincere they were was hard to tell. I mean, whether they were really recycling all this stuff or not, it was hard. So at times it looked as if it was just for show, that it was not really, there was just going into a pool just of stagnant polluted water that was just sort of sitting there. So I'm, you know, I'm not sure that the efforts are as effective as one would like. There's a lot of that sort of for show in the factories and in the tanneries of sort of what do we need to make people feel okay about this.
So you mentioned 3.5 million square feet for 600,000 pairs of shoes, an order of 600,000 pairs of shoes. Maybe you can kind of give us an idea of where is all that leather coming from originally? Right. Is it coming from China?
Well, some of it comes from China, but the vast majority of it comes from the States or comes from South America. And when I was there, the leather purchaser was a Brazilian who goes frequently to Dallas and works with the guys from Purdue, which is centered in Dallas. And that's where he buys the leather from Purdue, which I known more for their chickens, but also has cattle as well. So while I was there, they came, these two guys from Purdue. And I mean, it was like a perfect stereotype. They came in 10-gallon hats straight from Texas. And they came to the factory and did a little tour, and we did a little barbecue for them. So I got to meet them and chat with them briefly about it.
So that's obviously a pretty big carbon footprint. These shoes are getting, the hides are being shipped from Texas over to China, and then they treat them, tan it.
That's right.
Turn them into shoes, and then they ship that back all around the world.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine how much all going in and out of this Hong Kong port on these massive ships?
So the carbon footprint's enormous.
Would be enormous, absolutely. Ship that back.
But
and
that's
forth.
Still, because of our global economy, that's by far the cheapest way to do it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, because if you did what Trump wants, if you raise tariffs, as he's doing now in this current trade war, if you did what he wants to do and raise tariffs on shoe components and leather and things like that, and all that would do, the only person that hurts is the actual factory workers, the migrant workers living there. They would lose their jobs, and those factories would close down because the prices would no longer be sustainable for our market, and they would move to Vietnam and Bangladesh or North Africa, where a lot of these factories are starting to move. And the reason is this, they're not going to come back here, the factories, because if you really paid workers a fair wage here in this country, you would go to Target and you'd find a pair of shoes at Target you liked, maybe $300. And so ultimately that burden falls on the consumer, and no one's going to go for that here. No one's going to spend $300 for a pair of shoes from Target. So those jobs aren't coming back.
So you said you went to 4 or 5 different factories?
Yeah, I'd say about 4.
And what kind of range did you see in terms of labor practices and the efficient use of materials and sustainability? Was it all pretty uniform, or did you see a wide range among these factories you visited, Spencer? Right.
Well, I think the thing that maybe some people don't understand is just the massive scale on which this operates. So if you had to make 600,000 pairs of shoes, which isn't the biggest order in the world by any means, you would need 3.5 million square feet of raw leather. That's a lot of leather. One of the amazing things about the shoe industry is that it can't be automated. So you need human labor. You need hands to do all these. For every pair of shoes, it's about 90 to 130 individual processes. And people have to do them. They can't. They just simply have not invented a machine that you can just plug it in and it will spit out a shoe for you. That just does not exist. So that's why you need this massive number of people. Now, the way those people are treated really varies. And there's about 4 different levels of factories, from A down to, you know, A, B, C, D. I think D was the lowest. And you can get into sweatshops. You know, you can get into really grim places, but I also saw some places that are certainly nicer. And one place was making or hiking boots. And when you get into, I think, some of the more technical shoes, sneakers and things like that, it seemed like the factories were a little bit nicer and had slightly better accommodations and were treating, and the workers seemed that they had in better conditions. And certainly it went down from there. The cheap shoes that you would buy at Target or Walmart, those conditions there are pretty grim.
So the ones that have like economies of scale in place, where they're doing massive amount of shoes that are uniform as opposed to the more niche shoes, let's say rock climbing shoes or a waterproof running shoe or whatever it may be. They may treat their workers better, or they may have better sustainability practices in place because they don't produce the volume.
Yeah, because they don't produce the volume and they have higher skilled laborers. So it takes more skill as a laborer to make a very sophisticated hiking boot than it would to make your average flat from Target.
If you, my love, must think that away, I'm sure your mind is a roaming. I'm sure your thoughts are not with me, but with the country where you're going. So take heed of the western wind. Take heed of stormy weather. And yes, there is something you can't send back to me. Spanish boots of Spanish leather.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Spencer Wise, my cousin and the author of the new novel, The Emperor of Shoes. Now that you've explored the family business and you understand shoes better and you've written a novel with shoes as the background of it, when you go out and buy shoes, do you think differently about the process? Are you looking at brands and shoes in a different way than before?
Yeah, I mean, I'm leery, and this is cynical, but I'm leery a lot of the advertising that a lot of the shoe companies do about how green and how ethical and compliant and how wonderful the factories are. And these days, a lot of shoe companies and clothing companies actually market how wonderful their factories are. And I've seen that some of these places, this is sort of fascinating, some of these places have fake factories, staged factories, where there's one factory where it's really being made, and then there's another factory which is essentially like a show. And it's a place where they bring buyers who need to be impressed or need to be placated and show them, oh, and everyone looks very happy and they're working and they're singing away and wearing, you know, perfect uniforms and things like that, and make everyone feels good about it and they can go ahead with the order. So I'm a bit leery about that kind of marketing advertising. It's difficult because I think you wonder about, it comes down to sort of individual responsibility and choice. And I'm starting to think more about those decisions when I go, you know, buy a pair of shoes or something. But it's a difficult economy to get out of because there's just so few alternatives. When I read in New York, this group of women came that make their own clothes and make their own shoes and everything their own. And that's what they were advocating for, was sort of like, hey, break free from Target and Walmart and make your own stuff. I mean, I don't know if that's the way to go, but it's certainly something to think about.
So the father character in this book is, you've intentionally made him a lot worse than your dad. Yes. You've kind of made him into more of a grotesque. He's almost an archetype of a mean old factory owner, a ruthless capitalist going into this communist country. Your dad, my Uncle Bob, great guy, obviously very different from that. I'm interested in the transition that he saw in his generation from being a young man, seeing shoes made in the U.S. to seeing it made in these foreign lands. The fact that he was able to adapt to that and to these new cultures, he's done business in Eastern Europe and now in China for the last few decades, that is a real skill that left a lot of manufacturers in the U.S. behind. Can you maybe give us some insight into what he went through and how that informed your writing process?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to him constantly about this novel as I was writing it and researching it. I mean, endless conversations. And he was really passionate to share it with me. And in some ways, writing the novel, even though the father is somewhat heinous. And it was pretty funny because my dad would often stop me while we would be talking shoes. And he would say, "You know, this is really boring, don't you?" And he'd say, "I hope the book's going to be more interesting than this, because this is boring. You know, you better make the book spicier. You know, I hope you're going to spice it up." So, you know, I did raise the conflicts, and the characters are more outrageous. And the father is a bully in the book. And clearly my father's not at all. He's been immensely supportive of my career. But he has a genius for making shoes and being able to adapt. And he's sort of one of these last old shoe dogs that actually knows how to make shoes from scratch.
And he learned from our grandfather, is that right?
From our grandfather, absolutely.
And how did our grandfather get into the business? You did more research into the family history of this than I ever knew. So I'd be interested. Well, I don't know if our listeners are interested, but just from a personal standpoint, maybe you could tell me a little bit more about our family's history in the shoe business, if you can.
Isig Weistor came over. That was our great-grandfather's name. And he came over in 1909 on the SS Carmania, and they changed his name at Ellis Island to Izzy Wise to simplify things. So he came over in 1909, and he ended up basically selling shoe leather out of a horse cart on the streets of Beacon Hill, penniless. And he developed the business a little bit more and a little bit more. And he ended up becoming quite successful, and he had a factory, and he gave the factory to our grandfather. You know, like our grandfather made army boots for the Women's Auxiliary Corps in World War II. He made these Goodyear welt army boots for the WAC. But I think my dad ended up being able to had the flexibility to go to some of these different countries and be able to work with people on some designs. Now, a lot of young people go to NYU art school or something like that, and they could learn how to design shoes, but they can only do it in a two-dimensional form. They draw a shoe pattern. But my dad's one of the only people that really knows how to do it the whole way through and make a shoe from scratch. So that's why I think he stayed so relevant in the business.
Well, it's a terrific start of your career. I can't wait to read your next novel. I highly recommend this one. It's called The Emperor of Shoes, Spencer Wise. Thanks for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Grant Green, Steely Dan, and Nancy Griffith.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.